Michael Levin of the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast joins me to talk about the fantastic roller coaster known as the Philadelphia 76ers, baked ziti, and the shame that referees should feel. All that and more coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. They snuck out for a cigarette. She said, maybe it's the whiskey sours, but I think this could be it. If you ask me here and now, I know I could make those wedding vows. We could sneak off in the night, and I could be the bride. John Gennaro, count me in!
One, two, three.
The first words belong to The Good Life from their song Always a Bridesmaid off the 2004 EP Lovers Need Lawyers, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I'm grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to talk about the NBA into this microphone and that camera, and also to write about it. Imagine that. Number two, plums. I forgot that I had bought plums, and I found two in the crisper drawer this morning. Because I had two, it meant I could have one and enjoy it, and I didn't have a whole William Carlos Williams thing with my wife. And number three, I get to spend part of my morning with someone who I find to be a true delight. At his day job, my guest is a respectable writer and maker of television who has worked on shows like How I Met Your Mother, Young Rock, and Trial and Error, which was a personal favorite of my sainted mother, Pat Devine. He's here today, though, because of his seedy and disreputable night job. Along with Spike Eskin, he is one of the co-hosts of The Rights to Ricky Sanchez, the only podcast that has been brave enough to spend the last decade covering in all of their overwhelming absurdity, the Philadelphia 76ers. Friends, a warm welcome for Michael Levin. Mike, thanks so much for being on the show. How are you doing today?
Dan, I'm great. Always great to talk to you. Big fan of yours, as always, as I always say.
You do always say that. And frankly, to the point where it's now suspicious. I'm starting to wonder when the other shoe is going to drop. Speaking of other shoes dropping, well, actually, before we get there, we want to extend a hearty well wishes out to Spike Eskin, your co-host this morning. I believe underwent hip surgery. I know he was freaked out about it. I'm hopeful that it was as minor as hip surgery can be and that he's already on the road to recovery.
Yes, hopefully, fingers crossed, what we've been calling on the Ricky a hip swap, which is as niche of a reference as you can get of two concentric circles for like eight people.
That's all right. But I have to hope that eight of them are listening today. So
they must be.
We'll all extend those well wishes. But I've asked you here today to talk about the Sixers, a team that, if we can extend it back to my intro, for the last 40 years has been the bridesmaid. But Mike, could this year be the year that they become the bride? The Sixers have been one of the best and most fascinating stories of the early season, and they're a whirling vortex of emotional chaos, which feels built for the kind of consideration that's like lies at the heart of the conceit of this show. So that's why you're here today, Mike. And we're going to get into all of that. But first, even when we're caught in a vortex of emotional chaos, we at Divine Intervention like to start from a place of joy. So, Mike, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
Oh, man. I was out of town this weekend for a wedding in Mexico City. And so I saw people talking about Tyrese Maxey having scored 50 points before I watched the game last night after I got back from the flight. I thought that there was some sort of international ruse going on that fooling me that this actually wasn't real. And man, Tyrese Maxey, dude, I'm sure we'll talk about it a lot, but almost single-handedly saving the Sixers franchise by being as good and delightful as he is. And obviously the only reason we got Tyrese Maxey was because of Mike Muscala for hitting a three in the bubble. Thank you to Mike Muscala. Thank you to the bubble. Thank you to COVID-19 for bringing Tyrese Maxey to Philadelphia. It all worked out how it was supposed to. He's the best. I can't believe how good he is and how delightful he is.
Well, we can do the Maxey part now because him as sort of a radiator of joy feels like, you know, the vaccine for something that has been sick for a while.
And sure, maybe let's keep it going.
And maybe an antidote to some stuff that has been a real challenge for the Sixers. I know, like, even as you see the things that make you happy and there are wins and there are playoff series wins, et cetera, there's often, you know, waiting for another shoe to drop. There's often waiting for, you know, something lurking around the corner. And one of the big ones of the last year or so has been, you know, when is Embiid going to want to ask out? If, you know, if things continue to go sideways, is he not going to be happy here anymore? And then there comes Tyrese Maxey just kind of popping along and growing and radiating even more and more. And now it seems like Embiid is like as happy as he could possibly be and has the star that he needed. It feels like Tyrese Maxey is something that just as a source of excitement, filling kind of every gap that a Sixers fan could need right now.
No, it's, I mean, it's ridiculous. He came in at 20th pick and he immediately was like, oh, he can play. Like, he can play right away. He came out as a freshman year. He didn't have, like, a great freshman year at Kentucky. Was kind of playing between on-ball and off-ball. Kind of couldn't quite figure it out. They never have enough shooting around those guys at Kentucky. He comes in. He's immediately good. And then Ben Simmons' trade request year. And it's like, okay, well, he can take a bigger step forward. He can really own some of this. Do we even want Ben coming back? Do we want that? What do we want in return for it? And he takes a bigger role in that way. And then the Harden trade comes in, Harden trade part one for Philadelphia, and he immediately goes off ball and becomes an excellent shooter. He was not known to be a good shooter coming up. And over his time in the NBA, he has just gotten better and better and better. And his range has gotten deeper each year. And he's always been crazy fast and he's always had that floater. But then he just becomes incredibly dynamic off the ball with Harden. Now Harden's gone. And it's like, what the biggest possible step a player can make going from a good basketball player who can help out everywhere to you are now the engine of the offense. You are now playing point guard. You are lead guard of this offense. You have to get Joel the ball all the time. You have to get other guys open shots and you have to score for yourself. And that balance that he's tasked with, he has just done such a good job of it. There's like a crazy amount of stats that show the amount of like this many points and this many assists and this few turnovers.
Exactly.
And it's just like, since like Michael Jordan, it's just everything is, they are really absurd stats for how good he is. And really the most important thing, that's not the most important thing, but one of the most important things is he's so freaking great. He's so cool. He's so happy. Everybody, he like, soften James Harden by how happy he is all the time. Embiid like cracks a smile around him. PJ Tucker was like annoyed by how happy he is all the time. He just he comes in the gym bright and early. There is not a less Philadelphia type person to be as embraced by the city of Philadelphia as Tyrese Maxey. He is an absolute gem. He was just, you know, in between having great games, he like handed out like a ton of like Thanksgiving meals to kids around. He's just like,
right.
There's nothing but good stuff around Tyrese Maxey. And the fact that he has also gotten better each year as he's taken on a bigger responsibility each year. Like, I would say we don't deserve it, but also we absolutely do because we've been through a lot.
The thing that I flashbulb with me with Maxey is always, I remember he came to a post game podium singing the clap your hands, everybody song. And it's like, you know, you're about to sit down and face a bunch of questions. And he's like, you guys like that song? That's a cool song. It's like, well, you know, this is, if it's pandering, it's successful pandering. And, you know, we're certainly not going to argue about it.
I don't think he has a pander bone in his body. I think he's just a really sweet kid. I think top to bottom, he's just really happy. And even like last year, he took a bench role for a little bit because Doc wanted him to. And it was trying to get like Melton a little bit more, defense. The Harden Maxey defensive situation was always going to be bad. But Maxey has improved as a defensive player. Also, he had a couple like incredible blocks in that Indiana game. He tries. He's fast. He has good hands, like all that stuff. And whatever the Sixers have asked him to do, he has done it in such a beyond way. And honestly, they should re-record the song 10-9-8-76ers with Maxey singing it. He deserves it. He deserves everything.
Sixers PR, get on that pronto. You mentioned the deserving of it, and the deserve comes from a decade that we can't go through the chapter and verse of it all because this isn't actual therapy. It's just a pretend podcast about basketball, but I'm interested in your version or your relationship to it. You know, a decade ago, the Ricky started before that, you were writing about the Sixers at Liberty Ballers and you know, had been covering and following the team semi-professionally for throughout this entire endeavor. How has that shaped your relationship to it? Like, are you able now that it's a job after a fashion, are you able to get distance from it? Like, would you even want to get distance from it? Do you think you could? How do you relate to it having been there through all of it and like chronicling it in some of the most insane ways possible, sometimes shirtless, sometimes in the dark.
Mm-hmm. It's been, you know, you go through a lot of things in 10 plus years of doing a Sixers podcast. You know, you mentioned that the Sixers are always a bridesmaid, and I think that is actually giving them too much credit. They are more like the like wait staff. It's like, why are you eating? Why are you sitting down? You should be working. You should be doing something else. Yeah, it's been a complicated and at times fun and in times chaotic 10 years. Strange, unprecedented things seem to happen to this organization regularly. When you look at, you know, plenty of fans, fan bases, think that their team is either the like most unlucky or most hapless or strangest or whatever. And there's plenty of fan bases that are more unlucky than the Sixers and more unsuccessful than the Sixers and have, you know, lived in darkness and anonymity for a long time and has never mattered. But no team in the world has had as many strange, unique, singular, internet breaking things as our Philadelphia 76ers. And so it's always surprising. A few days ago, Kelly Oubre got hit by a car in Philadelphia. That's not funny for him, but it is a little funny in the context of how many things happen to the Sixers and the people around the Sixers. He's doing well, and I'm glad for that. But it's just an add another to the list that to Marco Fultz's shoulder, to Zaire Smith nearly dying from a sesame allergy, to Andrew Bynum being traded to the Sixers and then never playing a game.
There was a cosmic bowling component to that.
There was
not
a bowling thing. There was a flamenco dancing situation.
There was a flamenco dancing situation, yeah. Yes.
Even Embiid, this was during the Colangelo era, Embiid was ruled out for the season. And then I think that night or that weekend then went to a Meek Mill concert and was dancing on stage.
That's right.
Shirtless and dancing a lot and using those knees quite a bit. And obviously the Colangelo stuff, and there's a million other things. But, you know, they're a fun team to cover. I do love them very much, as they are inextricably linked to who I am as a person, and arguably my 80% of my personality. we'll have to run the numbers on it, but a lot of it at least. And, you know, I have been writing about them since I was like a sophomore in college, I think.
Right.
And so my entire adult life has been the Sixers. And the Phillies won a World Series in 08. The Eagles won a Super Bowl in 18. And both teams have had, you know, Phillies had a bad run for a while, but now they're successful. And the Eagles are pretty much always successful in getting to the playoffs and looking good. But the Sixers just have not, since 2001, broken through the second round and gotten to the conference finals. And that is a lot. That is a long time. The Kings have been to a conference finals more recently than the Sixers have. And for as many good players as the Sixers have had here, and as many, like, the Sixers have the best chance right now, according to Vegas, of winning the championship, they still have not broken through. And so it is a strange Sisyphean task rooting for and covering this team in the way that I do. But if I zoom out and govern myself by hope, and as a writer, which I am, narratively, it would feel so good if they ever do it. And I will look back at every single thing that went wrong and all the times that were horrendous. The four bounce Kawhi shot to eliminate them at the buzzer. The meltdowns against the Hawks in Game 7 when Ben Simmons refused to take that shot. And the just absolute no-show that they did in Game 6 and 7 against the Celtics last year. And I will feel, and all the other things we don't have time to name, I will feel like I have run 10 marathons back right to back and finally ending it. So I think about that sometimes. Daryl Morey's daughter actually did a little documentary about the song right when she got hired, when Daryl got hired by the team, and she was still in film school, and just asking about like our history with the song. Here Come the Sixers is the name of the song, And it's a catchy little tune, and it went away for a while, and it came back over the last like 8 years or something. And I think she asked, or I brought it up, like, what will happen when you hear the song when they're playing it, because the Sixers are, you know, the clock is, you know, ticking down, and the Sixers have just clinched a national championship on their home floor. And it is unthinkable. It is an unthinkable feeling to imagine what that could be like. And I described it as Gollum falling into Mount Doom, clutching the ring in his hand and then burning alive. And that, in a happy way, that is how I will feel.
Like, in a happy way.
I think my body has a good chance of disintegrating in that moment, but I will be happy as it happens.
Well, I mean, where to go from there is a challenging one, but let's zoom from the zoomed out perspective. I want to go a little bit further back on the timeline. So, because even in the context of this past decade, the past 6 months have seemed particularly manic. How would you describe where you were after the Boston series? After they're up 3-2, up in the fourth quarter of game six, and then they lose game six, they get blown out in game seven, the Harden situation's at an impasse. Where were you with the team at that point?
Well, physically, I was at my mother-in-law's house because it was Mother's Day when they lost game seven.
Right.
And I had to watch it in a spare bedroom when nobody was talking to me. And they did lose by quite a bit. It wasn't a close game. So at least I had time to compose myself. Right. I mostly melted down in game six. Game seven was just a funeral. Really pathetic. I was truly embarrassed. The Sixers had gotten so lucky that Joel fell to them at three when he was the best player in that draft, and that he missed his first two seasons of his career fully, and then came back healthy and has been relatively healthy since then. He's had little injuries here and there, and obviously a lot of things came up during the playoffs over the course of time. That's a lot of bad luck for him. But they were so fortunate to have him, and he has become as good as he's become. And now that Maxie's here a little bit, some of Joel's greatness has been sort of forgotten, or just at least expected, maybe. Like, he's an MVP candidate, so it's like, well, he's not this like precious little thing anymore. He's like one of the best players in the league, and everybody knows that. And it's not, you know, we don't have to like thank our lucky stars anymore for him because he's been here.
But a legitimate like miracle in its own right.
Absolute miracle, 100%. And this was the first time after that Celtics series where you really started going like, is Joel the right guy here? Like, I had never, you know, if I was starting from zero, I would not pick a center to be my best player. Obviously, Denver has just won with a you know, extremely singular player in his own right. But it just seems very difficult to operate in that way. And Jokic obviously operates from a different spot on the floor than Embiid does. But it's just really hard in the modern NBA to continuously punish teams in the post. They just have so many ways to get the ball out of his hands and make it hard on you. And it's hard. It's easier when it's prime Kawhi just penetrating from the perimeter and isolating or running pick and roll or whatever. This was the first time but I had not thought that, like, oh, Joel is not a guy that could lead us to a championship. I had not really ever considered that for any length of time. And this was the first time that you go like, maybe Joel is not the guy. Maybe it's just, obviously he's very good, but there's only a handful of players that can really lead you to a championship. And the Sixers, if you look at this Joel Embiid era thus far, have not beaten anyone good in the playoffs. Have beaten no good teams in the playoffs. The best team that they beat in the playoffs is the last year's Raptors.
Right.
Or 2 years ago, it was Raptors. Last year, they beat the Nets. Really bad. Really bad. I mean, just at a certain point, over 6 years, you should beat some good team in the playoffs. And they just haven't. And they've come close a bunch of times, blah, blah, blah. But this was the first time where I was mentally like far away from the idea that this team could compete for a championship because of how Joel looked, how sluggish it was. I think Harden's general loserness sort of rubbed off on him more. I think Joel is, Spike talked about this, like he is susceptible to getting like energy vampired a little bit,
like a vibe sponge a little bit more than radiating on his own.
Absolutely. And so you could see he started getting not into it, and you just go, and he'd also like sprained his knee and came back very quickly from that. Missed the first couple games of the Celtics series, one of which Harden played very well in. But yeah, it was the first time that goes like, maybe this whole fucking operation was absolutely fruitless. And you can't go back as far as say like the process didn't work or anything, because that was so many generations ago,
right,
and iterations ago, that it is amazing to even consider that people are linking these things together. But it was the first time where you go like, maybe this is just it. Maybe the happy ending of me burning alive at the bottom of Mount Doom with a ring in my hand is not going to come to pass. And so I was definitely in a bad place, and it was a bad summer, and it felt like pretty impossible. Felt like they were going to have to really draw an inside straight to get out of this situation, and they kind of did.
Well, you go through that challenging off season where, you know, no major draft addition, no major signings, no major big, you know, trade, you know, sort of shot in the arm for the team.
Yeah,
and I asked our mutual friend John Gonzalez this when he joined us on No Cap Room. Where were you when you heard that James Harden had called Daryl Morey a liar in China? Like, what do you remember about the experience of finding out that information?
Let's see. There's been so many moments, flashbulb moments. I actually don't remember where I was. I remember where I was when we traded for Andrew Bynum. I was at the grocery store and I was running home with bags of groceries like falling out of my hand.
Like, because you had to blog about it?
I had to blog.
Yeah,
you know the feeling.
These are very weird things and moments in your life where you're like, oh no, I had to like cut short this other thing so that I could write a blog post about Jeremy Tyler getting traded or something. Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
When the Jeremy Tyler, when the Ringer Colangelo story broke, Ben Dietrich story about the burner accounts, I was at a bar in Burbank having drinks with a friend, and I looked at my phone. I was like, I have to go to the bathroom. I was in the bathroom for like 45 minutes just reading the story. I was just like, well, what are you going to do? Yeah, crazy times. But yeah, I mean, Daryl is such a lightning rod for whatever reason. Obviously, the Hong Kong statement that got him in odd hot water for a very innocuous and correct statement. And then now, like, Harden is in China telling young children
at a basketball camp, essentially,
boss,
right?
He's a liar. And I'll never play for him again.
And that repeating it like, hey, kids, doubling down on this, making sure you really get it.
As if one of them like asked, hey, what's your relationship with Daryl? Well, thank you for asking, young
man. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. It was really just every time another seminal moment happens in a decade of seminal moments, none of the moments being like good moments, just seminal for in odd ways, I think I have the same look on my face where I just sort of like roll my eyes and like have this like shake my head for a while and have this like small little smile and just goes like, well, they did it again, they keep doing it, it just happens. But yeah, that was it's also tough because I that the avalanche of internet jokes is going to come down.
Right.
And I'm a comedy writer and I'm like, well, these aren't great jokes. These are the same jokes. And so then I think about it from a different perspective and it's like, well, it's all wrapped up into my personality, Dan. There's no way around it.
It winds up being like the inside of a baseball, just tightly wound strings all together, and the morass is difficult to untangle. But you mentioned needing to draw the inside straight, and then, you know, we get into the season and Harden's not playing, but the season, it starts to look okay. You know, opening night Milwaukee, they look good. Maybe should have won that game.
Yeah, could have won that game.
They have not lost since. It's become clear that Maxi is happening. As you're watching that, you described to be like, I am out, I am out, I am out. As you're watching those first couple of games, how are the wheels turning in your head and maybe, you know, elsewhere in your body as you're watching all that unfold?
Yeah. Well, one of the things, I'm not a coach guy watching a team and going like, the problem is the coach here. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes that's just not the case. And it's an easy scapegoat. And ultimately, like, the players are playing and it's almost always a personnel issue. And yet, did not like how Doc Rivers coached. Did not think he got the most out of this team. Now, obviously, Joel became an MVP and Joel's offensive game became like incredibly efficient under Doc Rivers and with James Harden feeding him easy passes a lot. But they were so stagnant. They were so predictable. And they'd get into the playoffs. And the stuff that was spoon-fed and easy during the regular season wasn't there in the playoffs.
Right.
Because the other teams knew to expect it. They were scouting it. They were working to prevent it. And because of that, plus Joelle injury stuff, plus bad luck, whatever, it just became, everything seems so hard and everyone's just standing around. And I think that's Doc. I think that's Harden's. The most frustrating thing about Harden for me was not the defense, was not his personality. It was just how little he moved on the court. He just, unless he had the ball in his hands, he's just standing there. And I think that's just really, really hard.
An ages old problem. Like, you, this goes back to when he first got to Houston from Oklahoma City. And it was like, well, no, this is the straightest path is just him with the ball. And then when he doesn't have it, forget about it.
Yeah. And you watch him this year and they don't have Harden and they don't have Doc. And I was expecting like a little boost under Nick Nurse. And I'm sure there's going to be ups and downs over the course of the season. But so far, man, like, they are moving. They are cutting. They're sharing the ball. There's a lot of dribble handoffs. Maxi's speed is game breaking. And, you know, they're not shooting that many threes. They're like one of the lowest attempts per game from three. And I think that's a little bit of a concern. I would like them to spray the ball out more and get those numbers up, because I think a team, you know, the Pacers, who they play tonight, for example, could just like shoot them out of the building because they get so many shots up, they get so many threes up. But, you know, these are quibbles. They look incredible. And they're playing defense. Like, that is the Joel's an excellent defender. And will deter shots at the rim just by being there. Will force tough misses, even if he didn't block shots. Like, his block numbers have never been excellent outside of really his rookie year. And Nick Nurse came in and was like, I want you swinging it more. Like, I want you swinging at shots. And his block numbers are way up. And the whole team really is, you know, Joel for a number of years looked worse on defense. And there's a thing that Spike brings up on the podcast about like a GM survey that did not have Embiid even listed among the best interior defenders in the league. And that should be a slap in the face to him, because he is, when he wants to be, when he's engaged. And you can tell this year he totally is. He's way more active on rebounds. He's way more active going after shots, and he has the guys behind him, whether now it's Batum and Covington and Tobias, who's made him turn himself into a better defender, Melton, a ton of guys that are just like B-ball Paul, obviously, who are willing to like compete on the defensive end and play with a ferocity and an intensity that really makes it hard to get easy shots against them. And that's going to come and go over the course of the regular season. But that to me is one of the bigger things, is like the coaching on both ends looks a lot better, and the team looks a lot more engaged because of it. And now we'll just have to wait and see until Doc Rivers calls his first Sixers game to hear his side of things, where actually none of it was his fault, and he wanted to play this way all along.
Right. There was Joel before the season saying like, I've always wanted to play in a more motion heavy offense and not so much ISO. Like,
a lie.
Right, but a useful one, and then sure. One when given the opportunity to show that he could do the other thing, he's doing it, and you know, they're actually reorienting the offense and finding the positive results from it. Which now that you mention it, I'm looking at it and I'm seeing Maxi in a like career high usage on ball role, a real backup center, B-ball Paul, who plays differently than Joel and is good. A bunch of wings who can shoot and pass. A lot of guys who run fast and dunk and go get loose balls. And a coach who has gotten them to do things like move and cut. Are you the shadow GM of the Philadelphia 76ers? Can you confirm that here on Divine Intervention?
No, I would not be a good general manager. They are playing exactly as I want to play, which is great, which is great. And I'm like trying to find, you know, every year I have a guy who I just hate, and we put him in, and I just hate him. Last couple of years it was Montrezl Harrell, who's just awful, who aged so quickly. I loved him as a prospect and just aged so faster than anybody else I've ever seen. He's like 28 years old and has just absolute tree trunk and the bounce of a tree trunk for thighs. But they are playing well. The thing that I would not be a good GM of is I would not be good at waiting. I would not be good at doing what Daryl did of the being uncomfortable, of the waiting for the right time. And I'm not good at negotiating. I'm going to probably write about it in the on the Ricky this week. But like I like having the information like right away. I don't like not communicating about something. I don't like waiting to talk about a certain thing. And so like Harden wants to be traded, I'm like, let's do it now. Let's just check it off the list and do it now.
You get it over with. Right?
Get it over with. I don't want to think about it anymore. Get it out. Done. If I get like a parking ticket, I'll pay it like right away. Because if I like, look at it for too long, I just get more and more mad. I was like, get out of here. I don't want to see it anymore. So I wouldn't have been able to do as good of a job as Daryl did at this. But they got what they needed. I never really bought the Terrence Mann like being a must have for Daryl in this trade. He doesn't seem like his kind of player. He is 27 and is just a fine role player. I like Terrence Mann. I've always liked Terrence Mann. I think he's worse than Bruce Brown. And that's important, but that's not like the thing you hold up a trade for.
Right.
But he got those picks and he cleared some cap space and he got expiring contracts that are all also very useful in Batum and Covington. And we'll see if Marcus Morris or KJ Martin break the rotation in a meaningful way. And it's just like they look top to bottom really, really good. And Kelly Oubre is going to be out for who knows how long. And they have the wing depth to replace him and make up for it. And that's just not something that you have seen from a Sixers team in this era. Like they have not been athletic. They have not been fast. They have not had a bunch of guys that could focus on defense and move the ball. The thing that they are a little bit short on is passing and perimeter creation from somebody that's not Tyrese Maxey. But in a playoff series, how much is that really going to matter when Maxey's playing 42 minutes a night? Nick Nurse is not going to shy away from playing his guys.
Certainly is not. No.
A lot of time. Maxey better keep hydrating now. But I wouldn't mind if they went and got somebody, if they packaged a couple of those people together and got some secondary creator that can also play with him. But you look at the way the team plays and you really start to go, what do you want to take away from these guys? There's a style of play here that is really working so far. And I like the way they're doing that. And I wouldn't want to bring somebody in with the newfound option flexibility that would make people start standing around again.
I think that's interesting about it from like an X's and O's on the court perspective, but it's also like the experience of fandom perspective.
Yeah.
This is a team that is giving you reasons to fall in love with it.
Yeah.
But there is also like, you know, what's behind door number two, which is you now have, there are those draft picks. There are those matching salary contracts. There is the promise of financial flexibility. So as you mentioned, you know, like you're not somebody who generally would want to wait for the gratification. There is potentially there.
Well, that's actually wrong. I love waiting for gratification. That's the whole process, Dan, is getting gratification down the road. That's my favorite thing is doing
that's
that. I don't like
point.
To wait for a difficult thing. A difficult thing right now is I'm like, just get it. Let me rip the Band-Aid, get it out of the way. But yeah, the question of Daryl could trade somebody for somebody between now and the deadline, or he could use his cap space in the offseason and sign somebody for free. And that the question of when to do that is a really difficult one. And we talked to Daryl about it on our podcast of like, and he's just like, that is the hardest part about being a GM is when to know when is the right time to pull the trigger on that kind of move with like the hope of something better in the future. Or like, does this meet the threshold of like helpful enough now to send a sacrifice the future a little bit or not making the move now because you believe enough in the future. It's a really like tough push and pull. And I again would be bad. I'd be bad at that.
Well, speaking of the potential challenge for you being bad at this, there is a player I was thinking of who's making like 8.7 this year and is like a partial guarantee for next year. Backup secondary creator, also with some ties. Could TJ McConnell as a vibes piece
sure.
be, you know, could you thread the needle there by being like actually helpful on the court, could play defense for a guy like Nick Nurse, and also just the, you know, infinity gauntlet of vibes of putting him next to Covington alongside Joel and Maxey? You know, would it maybe be too powerful?
It might be too powerful. Daryl he hasn't said this outright because he can't, but like he has made enough faces to indicate that he's not a TJ McConnell guy, which is tough because he would be beloved here. And it was funny, like TJ picked Embiid's pocket the other night and was like talking shit to him on the court. And they're obviously friends. And it's, you know, TJ has such a history in Philly. I don't think that's going to happen. I thought you were going to say Alex Caruso, which would be an interesting situation for a Bulls team. I don't know how much secondary creation he gives you so much. I think there might be a little bit of an overlap with Melton, but like
he might give you enough destruction that it essentially goes all the way back over to creation. Like
yeah.
the feedback loop of I just blow up every offense that I am across from, and then it winds up being net good anyway.
Yeah. If you're always out in transition, then who even needs a half court offense? That'd be interesting. It's fun to start going to, you know, the degradation of the treasure trove of assets that Hinkie assembled from 2013 to 2016 whether it was Colangelo doing that or then the post-Colangelo, like Elton Brand, who's in charge, Sixers shadow owner, random guys type of thing, era that they just sold off stuff. First round picks were just going. Daryl comes in, has to attach more picks to get rid of Horford, to get rid of Josh Richardson, and just like make it make sense a little bit more. And it did, and it has, but they have just been at a deficit of first round picks for a long time. And it's really hard for not just picks, but also like young players that are enticing to trade. There was a time when there was potentially Maxey was that young player, and then he became like way too good to trade. And I'm glad that they obviously held on to him. But just, you know, even in the Ben Simmons Harden trade, two first round picks went out in that. And so it was just, so you see these guys become available and you go, the Sixers have no chance to compete with another team when it comes to making a viable offer. And even just getting two first round picks back and letting some time pass to when, you know, 2031 becomes available, which sounds like an insane year.
Yes.
It starts to go like, oh, we are now a little bit. And as Daryl has said this whole time, which was frustrating before the trade, but now is fun and enticing. The Sixers are the only good team with cap space next year.
Right.
Like legitimately good. There's a couple of teams that I like. Nothing against like the Magic or anything. I like the Magic. But as far as a player deciding, hey, I see Maxey, who could make third team all NBA this year, which is crazy. And Embiid, who's one of the best players in the league. There's a really very obvious wing window in there for me, OG Anunoby, Paul George, if the Clippers, if Harden is a secret destruction agent to break up the Clippers and
It is a possibility we should at least hold some space in our brains for the possibility that not only was Daryl looking for an additional first round pick, but really waiting for the optimal time to just dismantle that team so that he could then pluck a part from it.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. And it is fun. It is a fun theoretical thought experiment where you're thinking, what are the possibilities? There's so many unknowns of going like, and we talked to him about the podcast without mentioning names, but say you could trade everything for OG Anunoby right now. Everything the Sixers have, all the picks that they can possibly trade, plus like Springer, some like useful guys, whatever. Or you can trade none of those things and hope that Paul George comes in free agency this summer. So just a really interesting, and then use the picks that you have to either make those picks, which they probably won't, or trade for more supplemental guys because a lot of the players on the roster are currently expiring. Just a really interesting question. And it's fun to think about where prior to the Harden trade, it was only death and destruction looking towards the future. And now it's like, oh, this guy could come. This guy, the vibes are fun. Nick Nurse is a guy that people seem to like want to play for, and he's an interesting coach, and he has interesting thoughts. And it wasn't just like the same shit over and over again, and the Sixers failing the playoffs. That's not to say that this year they won't still fail in the playoffs. I think there's going to be growing pains. Embiid has improved as a passer drastically, but or at least the players around him have been more open and more dynamic than they had been in previous years. But there's going to be growing pains with that. There's going to be growing pains with Maxey hitting a wall after he's playing as many minutes and is taking on as much responsibility as he has. It's going to happen, and odds are they're still not better than the Celtics. But the feeling, and this is a feelings podcast,
it certainly is,
is just so much more positive. If you're heading towards a destination that feels like growth and there's hope in there, then you can get on board with it, even if it ends up falling a little short, if you know it doesn't work out 100% perfect. But where they've been the past few years is on tilt, desperation, doing the same thing over and over again. Now, thanks to Maxey, really just him, the franchise would be in such disarray had they taken, like, this is not against, but like Precious Achiuwa, if they had taken Precious Achiuwa in that draft instead, who's a nice player, nice back of five, whatever, the team, Embiid would have asked for a trade by now, I think. And it just would have been, the era of Sixers basketball would have been such a complete and total failure. And because of how good Maxey's gotten, everybody feels, and also the winning helps, but just really, if you boil it down to just Maxey, people are feeling like, well, his mantra, whatever, is like getting 1% better every day. And that's such a corny thing to say. But when you see it work, you really get some buy-in. He's just like an earnest guy, really trying and really giving a shit and absolutely dominating right now. And it is good. It is good, Dan. It's quite good.
So the last thing that I will ask you about the Sixers before we move on to a couple other things here is just with at this moment, can you imagine enjoying a sports team in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Yeah, that was a tweet that I tweeted many years ago. And I don't actually remember what inspired
which specific
it.
Thing led to
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
right?
it could have been so many things. But the Eagles won a Super Bowl since then. And so I had to stop referencing the tweet because I didn't. The winning a Super Bowl against the Patriots in the way that they did was very good. And the city of Philadelphia set itself on fire and greased the poles and ate horseshit and all the good stuff that we love to do and hopefully look forward to doing in new and innovative ways if the Sixers ever do it. But the Sixers specifically, I did feel like it was hard to go because we are like, I think it's clear. We are like a fan podcast. It is not, mm-hmm. we don't cosplay as these like, you know, you're a Knicks fan. You're admittedly a Knicks fan, but there's people that are fans of teams that like, going,
I do like that it's shameful. You're like,
I abandoned that part of myself. And it's like, we are just this. We know we're this, but it's not, I don't think we're homers in the sense that, I think we are also more critical of the Sixers than anybody else.
Because literally anybody in like maybe the history of criticism.
Yes. But like it felt very difficult to imagine that I would come back in with this team, that they would do enough to earn me lining up, putting on my Charlie Brown hat and thinking that this is the time that I'm going to kick this goddamn football. And through the trade and through Maxey and how Nick Nurse has gotten the offense, the defense to look and how Joel looks bought in and the wing depth and all that stuff. I'm there, man. I'm lining up. I'm testing the wind. I'm feeling like it could happen. And it's just, I think the fan part of it is the crux of it, because you look around and it's not just, I want my team to win a championship. It's like, I want my team to win a championship in a way that feels like, I was along for this journey. These are my guys that can only happen through like time and shared trauma and all that stuff. And so I was thinking who would I trade Tyrese Maxey for in the league right now? And the honest answer is like, there's probably 15 or 20 players that are better or be a better fit or whatever it is. But the real answer for me is no one. I want it to be him. I want it to be Maxey and Joel, because those are our guys. And those are the people that we went to battle with and suffered through all the things that we've suffered through. And it just feels like if that is emotionally and narratively how it should be. And so, yes, I'm right now, for the time being, enjoying a sport in Philadelphia.
It's incredible. That roller coaster ride from it's so fucking over to we're so fucking back. And here we are. It's a beautiful thing to see. I'm very glad to have gotten the opportunity to talk to you about it. We're going to move from that emotional excavation of Philadelphia 76ers fandom to a couple of dopier things here. First is a little game called How Dare You? Mm-hmm. So maybe a game where we identify a shameful recent basketball occurrence and get very perhaps theatrically aggrieved by it. I can start if you want to sort of think about it for a little bit.
I got one.
You got one? All right. If you got one, Chamber, let's hear it.
Well, So I coach my wife's basketball team, my wife's adult women's basketball team. And I am frequently drawing the ire of referees, making probably $25 for a game. And I'm just like, dude, you're not fucking watching, whatever it is. I have never been teed up, but I've gotten pretty close a few times. So I'm a ref guy. I've always been a ref guy. As a kid, I'm a ref guy, whatever. I understand how difficult of a job it is at this speed to call the game. And there's fouls that they're going to miss. One of my pet ones is charge calls. I think they just love doing the charge gesture. I don't think that they're oftentimes looking at it. I think they're just like, I get to do it. I'm going to do it. I don't mind missed calls. What I mind as a ref and a how dare you situation is when they make it about them and they like stop the game. They stop the flow and momentum of a game to call a technical foul for like hanging on the rim or like mean mugging at someone, gesturing in any way. Like, it just doesn't need to be the case. And the most insane one is when they call a technical for delay of game and thus delay the game further by making them walk the other team walk to the other side of the court and take a slow one free throw. It drives me insane. And there's so many people thinking about how can we make the NBA regular season matter and how can we make it faster? And you saw baseball obviously make their games way faster and it was a success and all that stuff. And it's like, can you just tell the refs to stop being fucking losers and just like call the game and pretend like they don't get so, they're so soft and heated and they're acting like, well, they have to restore order. Like this is the fucking like Supreme Court. And it's just like, guys, it's a basketball game. You're allowed to like talk. You're allowed to get mad. You're allowed to like clap in a general direction. You should be allowed to suck it to the crowd, Joel. You should be allowed to do that without getting fined for it. And it's just all of these things when it slows it down and there's already basketball. I think the NBA should move to the Elam ending. I've thought this for a while. I think it's way more dynamic and it's how everybody plays pickup basketball. Like, why wouldn't it happen? The last couple minutes of every NBA game or most NBA games are total torture and they shouldn't be that way. But why during the middle of the game are you also slowing it down so the refs can go like, I'm in charge. Just so you know, I'm in charge. You think you're in charge? I'm in charge. I'm Mr. Ref. And it's just like, God, I hate him. I hate refs. I hate refs. I hate umps. I think it is a despicable career. And if you go to it, you should feel the shame of taking what I'm sure they make good money, but it's not, there's no amount of money that would be worth it to me, for me or anyone in my circle of loved ones to become a ref. My nephew umps games, baseball games in Arizona. And I'm like, don't even talk to me about it. Don't bring it up. Disgusting. Hate it.
All right. Well, how dare you, referees broadly? I like that as a sort of an umbrella term. For mine, speaking of last few minutes of a game being torture, how dare you, Washington Wizards? Their entire close to Monday's loss to the Raptors was just about 7.5 minutes of somebody wrapping their own hands around their throat and squeezing as hard as they possibly could. They led by 23 early in the third quarter. They led by 16 with 10 minutes left, and they lost by 4. 21-1 run over the final 7:25, a period in which they went 0-for-10 from the field, committed 6 fouls and 5 turnovers. They gave up a basket because they were playing 4-on-5 because Kyle Kuzma ran to the other end of the floor to ask for a review while the Raptors were about to inbound. They were inbounding the basketball and Kyle Kuzma just ran away. They had a chance to tie or go ahead with 7.9 seconds left or something like that. And they just inbounded to Kyle Kuzma stepping out of bounds. He was about to step out of bounds and they threw him the ball. It was Jordan Poole trying to go pick and roll against a whole bunch of really good pick and roll defenders, like all the Raptors, big guys that have long arms. They're just trying to cook and it was, everything was on fire. It was about as, like, all they had to, they could have punted the ball into the stands with 1 second left on the shot clock every time they got down the court and had a better chance of winning than doing everything they were doing. It was just like, I'm watching it and saying, like, this can't possibly be the way this goes, right? Even for a team that we established, like, everybody expects the Wizards to basically be, like, the new version of the JaVale and Nick Young, you know, Cinnamon Challenge Wizards, where it's just going to be a whole bunch of jokes and memes. But, like, even that, you can't do this, right? And they could do this, and they did do this, and it was disgraceful and shameful. And Wizards, how dare you?
I have such a kink for disgraceful basketball coming up for the process era.
It's true. You watched a fair amount of it.
I did. 10-72 was quite a year.
There was a moment where Thad Young said, I don't remember the last time we won. And yeah. I think he was being serious. I don't think it was like, I honestly don't remember the last one. And you're like, well, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. There's some dark days, man. but if I was a Wizards fan, I'm definitely not. You just hope for the accruing of assets and you start to go like, maybe somebody, I'm in the John Gonzalez fantasy basketball league and I won the championship last year and I'm now tanking this year and it is great. Anytime anybody gets hurt, I'm like, trade him to me, baby. Give me a pick. I'll take him. And there's a satisfaction in that of not having to care about every moment of everything. You're just along for the ride. You're taking advantage of other people's misfortune. And isn't that a nice thing? So hopefully the Wizards can bounce back for their sake. Man, Jordan Poole, this is how down bad we were this offseason. I was pitching a potential Jordan Poole trade for the Sixers. I was going like, well, they don't have many other options. No one's going to trade for Harden because he doesn't fit anywhere. So you may as well go like try to get him in a Tobias thing and hope that he bounces back to the efficient guy he was and maybe just bad for that Golden State system. Doesn't look right now, and I'm happy that he's not there. Also, Tobias has played great. We haven't mentioned Tobias, and he's been excellent.
This is true. It's been a pretty tremendous Tobias start, which I know also is a big feather in the cap. More dunking we could always have, but you know, a nice aggressive start, a lot of aggressive takes, which you'll have to see that. Before we get all the way out of here, we're going to wrap up with something we call the closing five, because how you start is not as important as how you finish. Mike, I know you understand that. It's not really whether you're on the floor at the tip. It's whether you're on there for crunch time. Five questions. Think about the Kilbourne Daily Show, basically. Here we go. Question one. You, as you mentioned, are the coach of your wife's basketball team. You are also a pickup hoops player in your own right. Which means more, a win when you're playing or a win when you're coaching?
Playing. Come on. Come on. Come on. Yes, playing. Absolutely playing. Playing if I play well. I'm not in the NBA. I don't have to pretend like I'm going to be happy if we win and I don't play well. What are we doing? Win when I play well, 100%.
You look good, you play good, they pay good. There you go.
That's good. And I make a lot of money playing pickup basketball, let me tell you.
Yeah, I would say it's going to be the reboot of White Men Can't Jump, but they already did that. Although maybe we should memory hole that one. Question number two. You are a professional comedy writer. What was it that made you laugh a lot when you were a kid, kind of made you want to do this as a career? Like, what stuff did you love growing up as a comedy fan?
Oh, man, a lot. My dad showed me so much Mel Brooks. So it's a lot of Mel Brooks stuff, a lot of Airplane, you know, the shows that were on at the time, Seinfeld, Friends. I'm trying to think of it. I mean, Home Alone. Watching Home Alone with my dad is a singular experience because he's seen it a million times and he's still going to laugh at it. And it's just, there's something about it that just works. And so that's good. Yeah. A lot of South Park at the time, like Simpsons, like all that stuff. You get inspired by a lot of different things. I was inspired a lot by rom-coms. I love a good rom-com. There's not so many of them anymore. Hopefully that'll come back. And even like in middle school, high school, kind of a crazy thing. I think it's more middle school. I was a big How I Met Your Mother fan, and then I went on to be my first show that I was an assistant on. And so that was pretty cool. The writers on the show didn't like to hear that I liked it in high school at the time, but I did. That was the case. Yeah. Inspired by a lot.
This is how I feel when Jake tells me like, oh yeah, I was reading you when I was in like middle school. And I'm like, shut up. I don't want to hear that at all ever, you little jerk. All right, question three. You can add one past Sixer to this Sixers team for the title push. Who would it be?
Oh, there's a lot. That's a really good question.
Thank Zach you. I'm a professional broadcaster.
Yes. Zach Lowe mentioned Andre Iguodala as a perfect sort of like can penetrate from the perimeter, can defend. It would be more like Warriors or like Nuggets Iguodala than it would be a Sixers Iguodala, because he was really like the number one guy in miscast in Philly. I mean, Covington would have been an answer because I'm a Sixer.
Well, if you could like go into the time stream and take out that Covington, and then now you've got two.
Yeah, we got two. that could work. I mean, like Andrew Toney would be a really cool answer as far as like a very like helpful shooter. I mean, Melton hasn't been very good this season. I think he'll bounce back and he looked a little bit better against Indiana. But having a two guard that could also defend, because that's the identity of the team, has to start on defense and also penetrate a little bit, I think would be really nice. I want to give another cool answer. Let's see. I mean, like a 1997 Jerry Stackhouse would be pretty cool if that could work out.
It could. I mean, I'm sorry though, the answer is Tony Roten, but that's okay.
Only go left and they couldn't stop him.
That's right. Well, I don't know how I wound up writing a blog post about it, but the collective of Team WAP, we handle our problems, is something that it exists in my brain. Like, you forget stuff from school.
Can you name all four of them?
Oh, no, I can't. I remember Tony Roten was intimately involved.
Michael Carter Williams.
Right.
Vander Blue.
Vander Blue.
Who I was texting about with our friend Alonzo Jones, who writes for us at the Ricky. yesterday, actually. I was texting him about Team WAP and Vander Blue. And Temple point guard Khalif Wyatt.
Khalif Wyatt.
Yeah, this is incredible. This is the early days of the process. This is what losing can do for you. All the possibilities that it presents.
That's right. So Wizards fans, just prepare yourself for in about 10 or 11 years to be able to have a lot of texts about. Yeah. Well, hopefully Bilal Coulibaly will be somebody good to text about. But
yeah.
Anyway, all right. Question four. You are a member of the Writers Guild of America.
Right.
You spent much of the last few months on the picket line advocating for a fair deal from the AMPTP, which I'm very happy to say the WGA got. And folks are now the SAG-AFTRA has also gotten their deal. They're going back to work. What is one major thing you took away from that time striking?
Oh, I'm wearing my Writers Guild shirt. I wore it for you.
Thank you, sir.
A guild member as well. It was my first labor action. And my wife and I were both of the shows that we were on, like show captains. So we would communicate. We'd sort of be the intermediary between like, okay, this meeting is just for captains or whatever. And there's like 250 of them or something like that. 150, I don't know. And then I would communicate to the like 20 people on the two staffs that I had been writing on. And it felt really, and then showing up and picketing and popping around different lots and talking to people about their experiences and stuff. And it felt really, really cool. Like it was just a very singular sort of like defining period of my life. It was a 5-month strike, second longest strike of all time. It was hard. It was long. It was at times demoralizing, but like the galvanizing feeling of like, they can't do this without us. And they're trying to up our business because they only care in the very short term about turning a profit. There is not foresight. There is not artistic integrity coming from the CEO class. And the only way that we are going to get what we want is by sticking together and demanding it and holding their feet to the fire and saying like, you're not going to get any of the shows that you make money on unless you pay us for this. And there were a ton of issues. Not all of them affected me. Like I've never worked in late night or anything, but hearing from other writers about those issues and hearing from like, you know, I've mostly worked in TV and dipped a toe in features here and there, but like hearing about like feature screenplay stuff that like they try to screw you in this way. It's just finding out ways that they try to screw you.
Right.
Because even though we're not, you know, making car parts or, you know, in the coal mines and stuff, like our jobs when they are going well are fun and glamorous and all that stuff, we are still labor and we are still being attempted to be crushed by management. And so feeling that solidarity, not only with my fellow guild members and fellow writers and writers of the past, especially who their strikes in the 60s and 70s and whatever got me the health insurance that I have.
Right.
And among other things, including the residual system that allowed me to like stay afloat during the strike when you like, oh, this episode that I wrote 5 years ago aired somewhere else and I get a check. And that allows me to like stay afloat during this like long work stoppage. That solidarity with those writers and also with writers and unions around America, around the world. It felt really cool to be a part of that and to feel like we are one of the big waves close to the forefront of the wave of like unions, people powered unions, like turning this country around and trying to like restore some of a middle class and some of a, you know, some of the power back to workers and stuff. And obviously there's a lot wrong with this country and unions aren't going to fix all of it, but being like a part of it that could help people, I thought it felt really cool. And I felt really proud to be a part of it.
As well you should. And now that you are back to work and others are back to work, here we go out with question five. In our hypothetical here, you get the Adam McKay winning time blank check. And the imprimatur is write me the dramatic show about the process. First role you're casting, who is it? And have you thought of a dream casting for it?
Well, I've thought about this and I've developed some stuff that are not this exactly. I don't think it's quite ready yet as far as like the story to be told. And if I got to write it.
I mean, you're
it,
not in Mount Doom yet. So yeah.
I think if I got to write it, it would be maybe a 67-hour movie. People have to go, there'd be beds that have people have to sleep through. You wouldn't be allowed to leave because I wasn't allowed to leave when I f-ing lived it. It would be too long. It would be absolute nonsense. But I have thought about this quite a bit, and there's different eras and whatever. It's weird because like, yes, I talk about it, but I am a writer, and people have talked to me about like, do you want to develop this like Sixers type show or this Sixers type movie? And then like it goes like a certain amount and then it goes away. And it's like, well, I don't want to like talk about it that way, but let's see. I thought it would have been very funny to cast Andy Samberg as Brian Colangelo. that is something I could say.
I love that. And then you can spin out from there, but just that image of, well, okay. What's the look of Samberg for that?
Well, I mean,
like, which era is he?
I think it's as he's aging. I think he is entering a Colangelo level possibility for him. Like a young hot rod Andy Samberg wouldn't be able to do it. But
wouldn't work,
but as he's you know, his head has aged and his collars could rise.
They could rise as well.
Could be possible. My writing partner was thinking Michael Keaton for Colangelo, but I think that's a little old at this point. But there's a sharpness to that also. I think there's a lot of possibilities. Colangelo is a fun guy to cast and a fun guy to think about because he's such an anti-hero type. Could be a villain, could be your protagonist, but is ultimately so flawed that I think you get a lot of drama out of it.
All right, listeners, do not bother Mike with this, but I want to hear your casting suggestions. I want to I want you to line some things up. If Photoshop's involved, so much the better. Mike, we wrap things up here on Divine Intervention each week with a weekly recommendation. Does not have to be about basketball, can be about anything. Something that you think is cool and good that the people that listen to this might enjoy, make their lives 1% better in the Tyrese Maxey way of thinking about it. So anything that you'd like to share with the folks?
Yeah, the best show that I've watched in a long time, I just finished and it made me laugh and cry every episode, was Reservation Dogs. Three seasons of a show on FX and Hulu. It's so good. I had nothing to do with it. I don't know anybody involved in it. I just consumed it and enjoyed the hell out of it. It's a really, really special show. And you can just tell when there's such a specificity of an experience, even though it's obviously not my experience. It is, you can really, they did such a good job of bringing us into this world that most Americans are unfamiliar with, that is obviously so on the surface. A lot of like reservations are not well off and sad, and there's so much, and the most of the art you see represented them in is all this like sad stuff and torture and just like, it's all upsetting. And obviously there's parts of the show that touch on that, but it really is like, they're so full of life and they're so funny, these characters, and whether the main characters, the side characters, or the older folks that they reference, and then the shows go back in time. Like, it's a really, really special show, and it is like what like we should strive to make and support, and I'm glad it existed. It was three seasons. It was beautiful. I loved it.
I love it too. It's a fantastic recommendation. You talked about consuming that. I'm going to go with something you can consume. My recommendation is make a baked ziti. Now, it may be a silly thing, but it's something that I did last week. My parents didn't cook a ton when I was growing up, but my dad cooked this, and it was I think it was the only recipe he ever taught me, probably because he didn't need a whole lot of patience to teach me noodle sauce, cheese, and I didn't need to have a whole lot of skills to learn that. But seriously, noodle sauce, cheese, and if you want to throw some other stuff in there, I personally like to throw a little sausage in there, little peppers in there, let it all sort of bake through. When you get 350, 30 minutes, and then the last couple of minutes, crank it up to the broiler, burn that cheese on top a little bit, get it crispy. It'll feed your family. It'll feed you. If you make a big tray of it, throw it in the freezer, it'll feed you for a while. You do not need to be good at it. You just need to like eating noodles, sauce, and cheese. And I feel like for the most part, people can get their minds around that.
Yeah, that is the next show I'm developing. It's just a show about baked ziti. It's people eating baked ziti, people making baked ziti, people thinking about baked ziti, people smelling baked ziti from the house next door.
And just sort of like wafting along, like floating out like a pie on a windowsill. I like that idea.
A lot of material there, for sure.
But yeah, it's a really rich vein to tap into.
Absolutely.
But There's many smart people that recommend many smart and wonderful things. I figured I should also recommend something that really is about, you know, where I'm coming from, my lens on the world, and my lens on the world often looks at baked ziti. We know that you have time in your life, listeners, for more than one basketball podcast in your weekly rotation because you spent all this time with me, and I cannot recommend strongly enough that you make time in your life for the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast. Being interested in the Sixers helps, but at this point, honestly, it's like at least as much a podcast about an old married couple yelling about bathrooms. So like if you like people who have a great relationship being warm and also yelling at each other, it's great. It is very funny. It is very informative. It is suffused with joy somehow, even in the midst of everything that the Sixers have been through in the last decade. And Mike Levin is a gigantic part of it. So the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast, say the name, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Mike, anything else that we can point people toward?
No, and you really should start at the beginning. Listen, all 10 years. It all adds up to it.
Well, question five was going to be, can you explain lick face? But I know the answer to that is no. Like, it is just on the listeners to go back and listen.
At this point, no inside joke is ever satisfyingly heard. And so it's better to not explain anything ever again, I think.
All right. Well, we're going to explain this much. That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. I want to thank Mike Levin so much for taking all this time to be with us. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. If you've made it this far, please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts, whatever platform you're listening on currently. Leave us a 5-star review. Helps us with discoverability and moving up the charts. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you again next week, and take care of yourself. You deserve it.